Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Keith Carey. I'm here today on behalf of American Family Mutual Insurance Company. This lawsuit concerns an insurance coverage dispute. American Family's brief raises 6 points. I'd like to address two of those points this morning. First, the insurance coverage dispute at issue in this case is a question of law, a pure question of law, and should have been decided by the trial court, not by a jury. And for that reason, the trial court judgment should be reversed. Second, the trial court judgment should be reversed because at trial, plaintiff presented no evidence to establish that the plaintiff's property damage occurred during the coverage period of the policy. Plaintiff presented no evidence at trial that its property damage was caused by an occurrence, and plaintiff presented no evidence at trial that plaintiff was legally obligated to pay any sum to anyone as damages. And all three of those conditions, the coverage period, the occurrence, the legally obligated, all three of those are provisions of the American Family insurance policy that's at issue, and plaintiff bore the burden of bringing itself within the coverage of that policy and failed to do so. I'd like to briefly summarize the facts in this case because I think they're interesting and certainly relevant to the resolution of this case. Plaintiff is a construction company. The construction company builds houses almost exclusively in Platte County. The house in question was built in 2003. It is undisputed that the house is currently out of level by at least 8 inches. In other words, the front left-hand corner of the house is 8 inches higher than the back right-hand corner of the house. It's out of whack by at least 8 inches. That's undisputed. Plaintiff says that it built the house, it's out of whack, but to plaintiff, it's a complete surprise, an unanticipated accident, and plaintiff blames that condition on bad soil. You're going to hear about a gentleman named Darren Sherry. Mr. Sherry is the sole officer, director, and shareholder of the plaintiff construction company. Mr. Sherry is also an officer and director of another company you'll hear about, CLT Incorporated. Mr. Sherry testified at trial that he's familiar with every step of the construction process, and he's personally familiar with the construction of this particular house. So I asked Mr. Sherry when I took his deposition, I said, well, you say this house has settled and is out of level by at least 8 inches because of bad soil. I said, Mr. Sherry, was this house that you built on fill dirt? And at his deposition, he denied that. Well, the testimony at trial was somewhat different. And so by the time we got to the end of trial, plaintiff's counsel told the jury, we don't deny that the house was built on fill dirt. Well, here's why counsel said that in closing argument. During the trial, we heard testimony from a county engineer who said the house was not only built on fill dirt, it was built on fill dirt that is 15 to 20 feet deep, and I'll tell you, that's about the height of this room. The fill dirt was put on this residential lot by Darren Sherry's other company, CLT Incorporated. That was undisputed. CLT Incorporated trucked in fill dirt, put it on this lot, and then the house was built on top of that fill dirt. But one of the interesting points is the testimony from the county engineer established that CLT Incorporated compacted that fill dirt on the area in front of this residential lot where the street was going to be located.
Isn't the issue here what accident means, not what the fill dirt was at this point or anything else, but whether or not you don't claim that he intentionally built it with the intent that it would sink or that it would be a bad house or it would be defective, but that he should have known that what he did was insufficient. And there's a question where he says that he thought the piers were sufficient to make it provide a proper foundation for. Why isn't that an accident? Why isn't that something that was not intended from the point of view of the insured?
Well, first, there is no allegation.
You're saying it was negligent, but why is that? Why isn't that nonetheless an accident?
First, there's no allegation that this was intentional conduct. There was no expectation that the house was going to fail. But Mr. Sherry testified at trial that there is a foreseeable risk. If a house is built...
He also testified he didn't foresee that this would be a problem, that he thought the piers would be sufficient, so why wasn't that a fact question?
Because he was wrong. In other words, he put the filter...
but that's... I'm not clear why that makes it not an accident. I mean, why isn't that... He was wrong because it did sink, but I'm not clear why that would not be covered under the definition.
His testimony was, if you build a house on filled dirt and it's inadequately piered, there is a foreseeable risk that the house will sink. And this house did sink, which means the piers were inadequate and failed.
Did he say he foresaw that the piers would be inadequate and it would sink?
He did not say that in this specific instance that he foresaw that this house was going to fail. Obviously, as the builder of the house, he...
So is negligence ever covered then by the policy? It sounds like it would not be.
Well, certainly negligence might be covered under some circumstances, but I don't
think... But isn't foreseeability, like in the Paul's Graph case, isn't foreseeability a jury question?
Foreseeability, no. No. The interpretation of an insurance policy on a coverage question like this is a question of law. Missouri case law is replete with cases of the
court. Clearly, what an insurance policy means is a question of law, but what the facts are, and so how that issue of law will be applied to those facts can be a question of fact.
I don't think that's the law in the state of Missouri. I believe not only is the interpretation of the language of an insurance policy a question of law, but a coverage question of how the facts apply to that policy.
So, for instance, if you had a case where somebody said, which is not this case, that somebody said, I asked him for coverage for my house and car, and then the agent said, he only said he wanted coverage for the car. It's a matter of law for the court to decide which of those is accurate, or is that a fact question?
That's a fact question about what coverage was purchased. That's different from a question of whether certain facts come within the coverage of a particular policy that was purchased.
Once you know the facts, correct?
Yes. Now, keep in mind, American Family in this case didn't sell plaintiff a warranty policy. American Family didn't guarantee plaintiff's own work. American Family sold this construction company a liability policy to cover it from third-party liability claims. And what we have here is plaintiff making a claim against its own insurance policy. Mm-hmm. Now, my first point in the brief and the first point I'd like to argue today is...
Who else would you make a claim against if you're paying for insurance and you expect to be insured? You think that you'd make a claim against your insurance policy if it's insuring the risks you pay it for.
But keep in mind, this isn't like a homeowner's policy where the homeowner makes a claim for hail damage to its own roof. This is a liability policy. It's designed to protect the insured, the policyholder. If someone comes to your house and falls on ice on the front sidewalk and that person who fell makes a claim against the policyholder, that's a third-party liability claim. Plaintiff is trying to make this like a homeowner's policy where a homeowner's got damage to the roof because of hail and wants to be compensated for it. That's a completely different kind of insurance policy.
But the question here is when did the claim actually occur? And your opponent argues that this was a progressive injury, and even though it didn't manifest itself until outside of the timeline of coverage, it actually did occur during the timeline.
Let's talk about that. That question hinges on two issues. When did the policy end? When did the coverage of the policy end? And when did plaintiff's property damage first occur? Let's talk about those in order. When did the policy end? Plaintiff Darren Sherry testified that the policy ended in December of 2003, and he testified it ended because American Family canceled him. He testified from memory. He didn't have any documentation, and Mr. Sherry's testimony throughout the trial is replete with him saying many times that he was reluctant to testify without documentation in front of him. But on this instance, he said the policy ended in December of 2003 because American Family canceled him. After he testified, I presented evidence that demonstrated I had an exhibit, an email from Mr. Sherry that he sent to American Family that said, I've got other coverage, cancel my coverage with American Family, effective September 18, 2003. We also established that Mr. Sherry didn't pay any premiums to American Family after that date, September 18, 2003. We also established at trial that Mr. Sherry procured other insurance coverage from another company, effective September 18, 2003. None of that evidence was rebutted by plaintiff.
Assuming for present purposes that we agreed with that the policy period ended in September, why, what is your answer to the argument that the occurrence occurred in August when the building was built? Because from that point onward, it had an adequate foundation.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the
last. It had inadequate foundation, and it was beginning to sink from that point. Why wasn't that the occurrence?
Keep in mind two things.
Number Not the damage, but the occurrence.
Keep in mind two things. Number one, plaintiff says the house sank because of bad soil. The soil isn't bad because it contains radiation or dioxin or some other toxic substance. The soil is only harmful and dangerous in this instance once it starts to move.
Well, are you saying it when it was first built, the soil and pairing was adequate to support the house?
No, I'm saying plaintiff has the burden of showing that if the house is in its current condition because of settlement, plaintiff has got to show when that settlement started. When did the soil first move? It's not adequate for plaintiff to say we built the foundation on this dirt in the summer of 2003, therefore the damage started in 2003. The soil is not dangerous until the soil starts moving, and there's no evidence in the record in this case.
Well, didn't the engineer's report say it would have immediately started sinking?
Well, there are a number of engineer's reports. John Evans is one of the engineers that plaintiff cites, and I quote John Evans' testimony in my reply brief. John Evans was asked the direct question, when did the house start moving, and he said, I can't tell.
How about your engineer's report?
That was my engineer.
But the other engineer's report that said it started sinking immediately, whichever gentleman that was?
Ken Sidorowicz was the engineer that they called. Ken Sidorowicz looked at the house 3 years after the fact, wrote a report, which I argue should be excluded.
Right.
That's a whole separate point. In his report written 3 years after the fact, he says the house started moving shortly after construction. What does shortly after construction mean? The house was finished and was sold to the initial homeowners on August 15, 2003. There was a walkthrough inspection on August 15, 2003, and everybody agreed the house was fine then. The policy expired 33 days later. Is there any evidence in the record that the house moved within that 33-day period?
And your comment just then addressed what I'm concerned about, and perhaps you can answer or distinguish. It's not a discovery question. It's when it actually happens. So you said no one saw it then. If we're to accept your argument, how is it going to be different from a discovery rule?
I don't think the court needs to even address that problem. Let's assume that it's not a discovery rule, that the question is, when did the house first start moving? Plaintiffs got the burden of demonstrating through substantial evidence that the house started moving, or that the dirt started moving, during the coverage period of this insurance policy. And so plaintiffs got the burden of demonstrating that the house moved sometime prior to September 18, 2003, and plaintiff didn't do it.
Thank you.
My time's up. Thanks.
May it please the court. Your Honor, in Missouri, an insurance policy is a contract, subject to all the rules of contract law unless specifically modified by the insurance statutes or the public policy related to insurance. American Family started out its oral argument by saying that the very first error it wants to address this morning is that the trial court allowed the jury to interpret the contract, which was wrong because it was a question of law, that is, what the terms of the contract were. It is true in Missouri, of course, that if the intentions of parties to a contract can be determined within the four corners of a written agreement that the parties agree is their written agreement, then the construction of the contract is a question of law and not one of fact. On the other hand, the case law says that if the party's evidence of the existence, of the very existence of the contract terms, is conflicting or is capable of more than one inference, then the construction is a question of fact.
You know, in the insurance area, and I don't know if you've read our recent decision in Burns versus Smith, where we addressed that it's an objective test, and you look at what one would understand the terms of the contract to be, and that if it's ambiguous as an objective question, you don't interview people and say what they thought it meant, what someone else thought it meant, and so forth. But ambiguity is also resolved in favor of the insured. It's important exactly what you're arguing. Are you saying that words in the contract are ambiguous, or are you saying it was ambiguous what the contract was?
I'm saying, well, kind of both. It depends which way.
And as to if it's the words of the contract are ambiguous, why isn't that under our law a question for the judge?
The initial question of whether a contract is ambiguous, certainly, Your Honor, is a question of law for the judge, which this court reviews de novo. We aren't really talking, however, in this case, about whether one word was ambiguous or one phrase. The parties can't even agree on what the writing was. The writing that they refer to over and over again is Exhibit A, this large document. It doesn't appear until June of 2005. In the 2 years before that, Mr. Sherry, for his company, had requested copies of their policy over and over again. Eventually, in April of 2005, they received this, which is a much smaller document, which contains none of the language to which American Family seeks to hold my client. At that point, the law of Missouri says that the entire question of what the terms of the contract were is a question of fact.
Now, opposing counsel says you agreed that Exhibit 37 was the contract that
we do
that
not.
Governed.
We don't agree that any exhibit in the record actually constitutes the contract. All of them say on the right-hand corner in most of the policy pages that they were created. These documents were created in 2005.
Well, copies that were created? Because you got copies of the policy along the 19 years or whatever you had.
He did. They didn't have, at the time of trial or beforehand, they didn't have any of those. Really, what the law is that we have two parties who agree that they entered into a certain type of contract. They agree that they had the contract, they agreed what the subject matter of the contract was, but they could not agree on what the written terms were. And I apologize that neither of the parties briefed this, but I found a case just within the past week that's pretty much directly on point. It's called Whitington versus Whitington. It's 659 Southwest 2nd 542, and I will send a supplemental case citation to the court. It's not an insurance case, it's a divorce case, but it's about a prenup where the parties agreed that they had a prenup, they agreed that it was a prenup, but neither of them could agree on what the terms of the prenup were. The wife's counsel sends the husband's counsel a letter saying, this is a copy of the prenup. The husband says, I didn't agree to any of that, that's not what the terms were. Therefore the judge said, well, it's a question of fact. I'll hear evidence from both sides as to what they contracted to. And the Eastern District affirmed.
Well, at the time of the supposed execution of the prenup, didn't the husband send back a letter saying, I don't agree to all this, or did just let it go?
They agreed that they had a meeting of the minds and agreed on the prenup at the very outset. It was just later when it came time for divorce, 10 years after they got married, they had this problem where neither could agree on what the terms of the actual written agreement were. That's what happened in this case.
So what are you saying the fact question was for the jury to decide here?
The fact question was, what was the intent of the parties in executing their contract?
Why is that a fact question for the jury? Because the contract isn't the question you're saying was what the contract was.
The question isn't what the contract was. American Family stipulated before trial in this case, Your Honor, that they had that Mr. Sherry had, or the Sherry Construction had, a commercial general liability policy with American Family. They actually admit in their answer that the dates of coverage were December 2002 through December of 2003. It's on page 8 of the legal file. I think it's a little disingenuous at this point for them to say that, oh no, it was in September. All that doesn't matter. The only thing that the parties could agree was what the subject matter of the contract was, and what law related to that, in terms of insurance law. That the dates of coverage were what they were.
What is the factual dispute? You have two documents there that are marked as exhibits that have been submitted as the contract.
No, they have not been submitted as the contract, Your Honor. They were submitted, American Family submitted their Exhibit A as the contract.
As the contract. Okay, now I understand that this was probably a contract that was kept on a number of computer forms.
Maybe. That's not in the record.
And when they print those out, regardless of whether you have seen them before or not, your client has seen them before or not, what evidence is it that that wasn't the right set of computer forms?
Mr. Sherry testified on page 314 of the transcript that when he was given Exhibit A, he said, I've never received anything that thick. That wasn't what I agreed to. And then he was asked, well, is this a little more like what you had received, Exhibit 37? And he said, yeah, it's you know, I don't remember if those are the exact terms, but that's a little more like what I agreed to.
Why does it matter which one it was? I mean, I understand one contains the occurrence language and the other doesn't, mm-hmm. but you also don't seem to depend on that because you say it was an occurrence during the policy period.
Yes.
I'm unclear why the intent of the parties was for the jury. On what basis is that?
The intent of the parties was for the jury because the parties couldn't agree as to what they actually did.
Why is the question ever their intent? Isn't it what the policy was and then what it meant?
It is what the policy was and what it meant, but in this case, they couldn't even agree on what the language of the policy said.
Yes.
Who had the burden of proving that there was a policy and it had provisions that gave coverage?
We had that burden at the outset, and before trial, as I say, the parties stipulated that there was an insurance, that they had an insurance contract. They stipulated what the dates were, and they stipulated that it was a commercial general liability insurance policy. Therefore, we met our burden to show that Darren Sherry had a commercial general liability insurance policy with American
But you didn't
family.
Submit a fact question about what were the terms of the policy. So
we did submit that fact question.
No, you said was the cause of damage covered? And why? And opposing counsel says, isn't coverage once you a legal issue? I mean, it may be a factual question on what the terms of the policy are, but then it's a legal question mm-hmm. whether those terms cover this incident.
Yes, I completely agree. And in a lot of cases like this, the language that we would use about the jury would be an advisory jury to determine the fact questions that are at issue. I believe this was an advisory jury. It just never says it in the record. Under Rule 7303, American Family had the burden of requesting findings of fact and conclusions of law if it wished. It did not at any time. I think that the court wanted the jury to determine whether, since we couldn't agree on any of the coverage language at all in these policies or these various documents or what even constituted the policy, coverage then becomes, did the parties intend that the policy that the agreement they entered into would be that American Family would cover this kind of loss. Mr. Sherry testified that his insurance agent specifically told him, yes, this would cover these kinds of losses. American Family disagreed with that. The question of the intent of the parties, therefore, which can't be determined from just a simple four corners reading of the agreement, is a fact question for the jury. In MAI 2606, it provides specifically for when a jury is determining what's at issue in a bilateral contract and whether there was breach of. And I think that's exactly
what was the basis for the jury to find this was covered?
Mr. Sherry testified that he and his insurance agent, Gary Weaver, who they admit was an agent of American Family in their answer, had discussed these kinds of scenarios. Mr. Weaver required him to give plans and lot platting to him for every house he built.
But the misrepresentation claim ended up getting dismissed out against him. So
I wasn't bringing that up in the context of misrepresentation. This is in the context of what did the parties intend? What did they agree to? He said, Mr. Weaver told me that this would cover that. And therefore, there is a question, a disputed question of fact, as to the intent of the parties in entering into this agreement. And I think the Whitington case, which I mentioned before, really shows that pretty well. But to the extent that the parties could agree on some term, the term that, and I think it's the one that's really at issue in this court, is this discovery versus the occurrence. That is, did it occur within December 2002 to December 2003. Since the parties, at least ostensibly from American Family's answer, agreed that those were the coverage dates, and at least viewed in a light most favorable to my client, that was the coverage date. We most certainly showed that.
Counselor, my question is one of proof. Given the fact that you had a walkthrough, nobody found anything wrong, when is your loss?
Well, the fact that someone walked through and didn't find something wrong, I think is kind of irrelevant. And I think the Scottsdale case that we go into was also about an inspection. In that case, it was a negligent inspection. They were suing a termite company. But
both parties were there, were they not? The prospective buyers and the developer as well?
In which circumstance?
When you had the walkthrough, wasn't everyone there to see any damage that might be occurring?
Yes, there was a walkthrough, and they couldn't find that. But I think we have to pay attention to the standard of review when you're asking this. You have to reject any evidence that, or ignore any evidence or inferences that are adverse to the judgment.
Well, you're saying it was latent rather than patent, and they didn't find it. I mean, it was a latent problem, is what you're saying? It wasn't, or they just failed to find it?
Very much so, Your Honor. I think the evidence that the jury could have looked at to determine whether this occurred within the coverage period or not is pretty, it's substantial enough. The evidence was that construction took place in the first half of 2003, and the parties closed on the house in August of 2003. Ken Sidorowicz, our expert, stated in his report that, quote, the settlement issues with the foundation began to appear shortly after closing because the home was for the most part constructed out of level. The construction occurred in the first half of 2003. The parties don't dispute that.
It was constructed out of level?
It was, for the most part, constructed out of level. That's correct, Your Honor.
Does that fit within the definition of occurrence?
First of all, Your Honor, I reject that the term occurrence is actually at issue here. The jury was free to disregard the idea that the word occurrence is even in this contract because we don't agree that the word occurrence does appear in the actual agreement.
Well, in your agreement, what is the insurable event?
I think it's a general principle of commercial general liability insurances, or just insurance in general. If American Family is telling, or if the parties intended, and the jury can say that the parties intended for the contract to cover this kind of loss, then it did.
Yeah, but it wouldn't cover a loss that happened 20 years ago or 20 years from now.
No, of course not. It would have to happen during the coverage period. We absolutely agree with that. But they could have seen from that report, and as well as John Evans's report, which says the home was constructed out of level to a great degree. Mr. Evans also admitted in his deposition, which was read to the jury, that the foundation cracks and sheetrock cracks indicate movement from the time the home was built. And I mean, that evidence is good enough. The occurrence is the home moving. I mean, if we are going to go with this occurrence language, I think we still satisfy the burden of proof just fine. If the foundation cracks and sheetrock cracks indicate movement from the time the home was built, that the jury was intended to rely on that.
But was this damage discernible if you had a geologist, or is that too expensive to hire for a house? I mean,
I wouldn't know,
geologist,
that's not
someone
on the record.
Figure out that this was going to happen?
These things have happened and actually have been upheld as requiring coverage under American Family boilerplate general liability insurance policy. Even if you accept that their contract, the thing that they proffer, which I think the jury rejected, was the contract, then according to the Wisconsin case we cite, it's still covered.
If it wasn't an occurrence policy, because that language in then, I think Judge Price is asking what does have to have occurred within the policy period, if not an occurrence. Something has to have happened to trigger coverage.
I think the problem I'm having is the use of the word occurrence. It's an event of loss. I agree that there has to be an event of loss that occurs within the coverage period. I mean, that's a basic principle of insurance law. In this case, I think we satisfied that simply because we showed conclusively that the movement began. Homes are not designed to move. The home moved. And that happened when the house was built.
Yeah, but
your client
moved?
Built it. It was your client that built it. You're saying it's defective from its inception, but it was your client that built it.
Yes, it was my client that built it, Your Honor. That doesn't make the whole thing not covered. The fact that my client built the house, it's not in dispute. He built it. There was an accident that occurred after the building or during the building.
Is an accident what is required to occur? I think on your burden,
an accidental event.
You have to prove that an insurable event occurred.
Yes.
Now he's got to prove his exclusions and conditions and all
sure.
that. But you've got to prove that an insurable event occurred. And you've got to show me some language. What is the definition of an insurable event from your point of view?
From my point of view, I would accept that it would be some kind of accident or an exposure over time to a dangerous condition.
Well, it's an accident. What's the accident here? Nothing accidental occurred. The house was built on loose soil and sand. That's not an accident.
I think it was. I think it was an accident, Your Honor.
What's the definition of occurrence in the policy?
Or accident. Yeah.
Right.
That's something that, the jury had to determine as a question of fact. I mean,
that wouldn't submit it to the jury. That issue wasn't submitted to the jury.
The whole issue of what the parties agreed to was submitted to the jury. I think the jury instruction, the verdict director, shows that very clearly. Did the parties enter into an agreement whereby American Family had to cover this particular loss? And was there damage to the home? There was. The damage was accidental. Mr. Sherry testified that he could not foresee that the home would...
The definition of accident was an event that takes place without one's foresight or expectation, an undesigned, sudden, or unexpected event. Oh, that's from a case that's been... Okay.
Yes,
Does
Your Honor.
Does the policy have a definition of accident?
The policy, once again, we dispute exactly what the language of the policy was.
But don't you have to prove what the language of the policy was?
I think we did. Absolutely. And I think that
they... Because an occurrence is an accident, including continuous or repeated exposure
yes.
to substantially the same harmful conditions, but then it doesn't define accident?
It doesn't define accident. If you're going with American Family, just for the sake of argument, if we're going to go with that this was the contract, and that's something that the jury could have determined, and even if it did, then, yes, it doesn't define accident, and I think Mr. Sherry testified that this was not foreseeable. I think, Judge Stith, you picked up on that earlier. And as a result, this was an accident. It was an accidental damage to a house. And with that, I would ask the court to affirm the judgment below.
I want the court to understand that plaintiff's position is that this case was properly decided by the jury because there were ambiguities. Let's talk about the alleged ambiguities that plaintiff has alleged. Plaintiff says there was an ambiguity because the parties couldn't even agree on their intent. Well, if there was no meeting of the minds in this case, then there was no contract in the first place, and if there's no contract, there can be no breach of contract claim. If plaintiff is going to pursue a breach of contract claim, it is plaintiff's burden to establish the elements of that claim. And the first element of a breach of contract claim is that there was a contract.
Of course, he says there was, but it just didn't include this occurrence and accident definition language, that it was 16, not 17, that governed.
Plaintiff says there were numerous different policy documents, and we can't tell which one was the policy. If that's the case, then there's no contract and there's no breach of contract. This is called a smokescreen.
Well, that's really a little difficult when insurance companies keep all their insurance policies on computer forms, and what you get is a deck page, and you never
exactly.
get all that document. So I'm not sure you want to be throwing that rock, do you?
Yes, because Mr. Sherry testified, and his testimony is quoted in my brief. Mr. Sherry said, of course I got the policies.
Well, but he said later. I mean, he didn't get all the pages. You admit he never got all the endorsements and attachments?
That's not true. I don't admit that at all. And I think Mr. Sherry admitted he got the policy. And what's worse about this is the policy that American Family admitted at trial, Exhibit A, is the same policy that they attached to their response to my summary judgment motion. It's the same policy that they alleged in their petition was breached. If we can't agree on what the policy was, then there cannot be a breach of contract claim. Furthermore, plaintiff wants to talk about ambiguities. Show me where in the verdict directing instruction the jury was asked to resolve any ambiguities. The jury wasn't asked what the intent of the parties was. The jury wasn't asked to decide which policy was the policy. The jury wasn't asked to decide where the ambiguities were in any of the terminology that plaintiff alleges were ambiguous. The jury was asked none of that. The verdict directing instruction appears at the legal file on page 38, and it's quoted in my brief, page 23, and it asks a single question. Was this property damage covered by the policy? That's a legal question that should have been decided by the court, not by the jury.
Can you address something I have a question on? I can't find that chart in the brief, but there's the chart that sets out all the different policies
yes,
and the coverage
yes.
period and so forth. And I know in your reply you said, you know, there wasn't room to go line by line and address it, but they show a coverage date of policy 16 and policy 17, both of which would include the September date. Can you explain that to me?
I can try and walk us through this, but this is complicated stuff. Exhibits policy 16 was the predecessor policy. It ended in 2002, and it ended at that point because Mr. Sherry requested additional property coverage, and by requesting that additional coverage, that converted the policy from the 16 to the 17 policy.
They say that that the policy has a date on it showing it goes through September 2003.
Yes, and here's how that happens. When the policy is issued, it comes with a declarations page, and the declarations page says the policy starts on this date and ends on this date. That's the declaration page for the number 16 policy. But during the number 16 policy, Mr. Sherry asked for additional property damage coverage. That had the effect of converting the policy from the number 16 policy to the number 17 policy, and it's the same policy, it's just given a new number.
If I understood correctly, and all the different policies are confusing, it's the 16 policy that does not have this occurrence language.
Yes, it has the occurrence language. The policy that the alleged policy that doesn't have the occurrence language is what plaintiff keeps referring to as its Exhibit 37. Plaintiff says Exhibit 37 is the golden standard for deciding which what the policy language is.
And you're saying that wasn't 16 or 17, it was a hodgepodge of different
things. It's a hodgepodge. That's the perfect word. Exhibit 37 contains an affidavit, contains a notation from the agent that said, I faxed 22 pages to Darren Sherry. Exhibit 37 includes an affidavit from Darren Sherry that said, I received 14 pages.
Thank you, counsel.
Exhibit 37 contains 42 pages, including multiple copies. It includes a land survey. It's a hodgepodge. It means nothing.
Thank you.
Any further questions? The case will be taken under submission.